Gary Lachman is a founding member of Blondie and in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But tonight, it's not that that gets our attention, although there's nothing that's cooler than being able to say for the rest of your life you're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. But it's his work as a writer, and I think in large part here, a researcher into Carl Jung, into the occult, into mysticism, its impact on politics. We'll talk about that coming up. But also just how it is that somebody like Carl Jung could have been involved in so many paranormal experiences in his life. Hey, Carl Jung is often cited by people whom sometimes I refer to as sort of the radical rationalists. They, you know, one of those kind of, you know, people who like to argue that there is nothing more than what we can see, things we can touch, feel, taste, whatever, and that there is no such thing as something that is supernatural. And they take the position that a real intellect, that somebody with a super evolved brain would know, that there is just nothing more than what we experience, and then we die, and then that's it. Well, it's hard to find somebody smarter than Carl Jung. He was a founding father, really, of modern psychoanalysis as we know it today, and somebody who experienced quite a bit of paranormal activity in his lifetime. And it's fair to call him Jung the mystic for all sorts of reasons, which we'll talk about in just a moment. But we'll also take a look at how the occult is still affecting us today, and how much of what we experience or think we're experiencing can be really, I think, very well understood by the mysticism that Carl Jung taught, even though he didn't want to take credit for it in his lifetime. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. You know, let's do one quick process question before moving on to other subjects. Gary Lachman, Gary Valentine Lachman, for people that follow those early years of Blondie. Do you use Valentine anymore, Gary, under any circumstances?
Not really. I mean, I wrote one book about my music days called New York Rocker using Valentine. And I mean, it comes up in situations like this, but, you know, that's all right. I can't get away from it. It's there. It's part of my life.
Hey, there's worse things to have to be associated with from your past.
This is true. This is true.
And let me just say, you know, you left Blondie just as Blondie was beginning to take off. You had already had some success with the group, obviously, but their later meteoric rise had yet to really establish itself yet. Do you ever regret leaving Blondie just before, you know, the big wave, the big Blondie wave came?
Not really. I mean, you know, yeah, of course it would have been fun to, you know, go on world tours and, you know, be on a few more albums. I mean, the one thing that I would have liked was to have had a couple more songs recorded, because I wrote quite a few songs. I mean, I later recorded them with my own groups and stuff like that, but, you know, they didn't get quite the notoriety that my first group did. But in general, no, because, you know, I went on to do, well, in fact, it's very apt to Jung, because I went on to follow who I was, you know, to become who I was. And oftentimes you have to make sacrifices to do that.
You know, the book Jung the Mystic, The Esoteric Dimensions of Carl Jung's Life and Teachings, is a new biography by Gary Lachman. But let me say, I will reference the book many times. I will plug it consistently through the show. But I may depend on you to bring the material into it tonight, because I have some, at least in the beginning here, if you don't mind, I have sort of some broader questions to start with you. And then it may happen that we get into some of your most recent work. But you have had such a very interesting, dedicated intellectual pursuit into the occult and mysticism that I wanted to ask you first. If you could define those for me and for others, I think I know what it means for me, but how do you define the difference between mysticism and the occult?
Well, I would say in general, the difference between magic, let's say, and mysticism, whereas mysticism is generally about union with God or the deity or some transcendental being. Your own small little ego is absorbed into a larger sort of supernatural force or being. You know, so you have many Christian Catholic mystics who have nothing to do really with the occult. The occult basically means hidden. It comes from an astronomical term when the sort of moon passes in between the sun and the earth. So the sun is occluded by the moon then. So it's basically, it just means hidden. And for many, many years, these hidden forces or hidden aspects of reality were quite prestigious pursuits. Isaac Newton, who's recognized as sort of the father of modern science, he wrote much more about alchemy than he did write about gravity. And gravity itself is an occult power because no one's ever seen it, and it operates at a distance. So when it was initially proposed, it was considered some sort of occult force, some sort of hidden sort of force. But moving on from that, I would say the difference is with occult, even though it's a very large, broad sort of term, these days it's used to mean anything from flying saucers to ESP to Satanists. And basically, the difference would be somehow having some control or some mastery to some degree of these sort of forces. So I'd say the magician doesn't lose his ego or his sense of self in some broader, larger kind of entity, whereas the mystic does. He sort of is absorbed into a larger thing. And generally, mystics avoid sort of trying to develop any kind of, you know, occult powers. They consider that sort of a lower sort of form of development. And they and most of the great religious teachings, whether it's Christian or Hindu or Buddhist, they all sort of say, well, you know, these sort of things will happen, but, you know, basically don't pay too much attention to them because they're not that important.
I think you hit on that very well. I was looking into it just because I wanted to make sure that I got it. I agree completely. Mystic. I love some of my favorite writers are Christian mystics, but even Jewish mysticism and the Kabbalah and Islam, they all tend to transcend to the same point. Mysticism, when it comes out of any one particular religious orientation, all kind of comes to the same nexus, don't you think?
I think you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, as the saying goes, there's many paths to the mountaintop. You know, so you can go either. I mean, all of the major religions have a form of mysticism. You mentioned Kabbalah, there's Sufism, which is part of the Islamic tradition. Buddhism, many ways for Westerners, it seems rather exotic, but it's pretty mainstream. You know, religion in the East. You could say something like Zen Buddhism in Japan is a kind of mystical aspect of Buddhism. So yeah, it's something that's there, and I think you're absolutely right. In essence, it's all sort of pointing towards the same kind of goal, as it were.
And the occult is interesting to me, but it doesn't ultimately fascinate because it seems so. So subjective in the sense that some person, you know, can say that this will happen if you do X, Y, and Z, something will happen because that's true for them. But when I try doing that, I get nothing. And then, or I, you know, I'll follow something. And so it's like the idea of experimentation and the experience of the individual in a cult. It's interesting, but I want to make that point because I think that you, before we get into Carl Jung and some of the other things we want to talk about, I'm fascinated by this book title that is not a book I actually have, but I saw it listed on your Amazon page, Politics and the Occult, the Left, the Right, and the Radically Unseen. So talk to me about that.
Well, I mean, basically I wrote that book for a few reasons. One is that most sort of accounts of, say, politics and the occult tend to focus on the right-wing aspects of it. And in a very popular sense, it's usually about the Nazis. It's about, you know, Hitler was a black magician, or the Nazis are really into all this occult sort of stuff, and the whole rise of National Socialism and so on was part of some vast you know, dark scheme. And while it's true that some people in sort of the Nazi regime were interested in some forms of occultism, I mean, Hitler really wasn't, and it really wasn't anything that was as key as many of the popular books would present it. But I wanted to show that there's a tradition in the West of a kind of progressive occult politics. I wouldn't say left-wing so much, but you have people like the Rosicrucians starting in the early 1600s who brought together interests in alchemy and astrology and a variety of other sort of occult practices with a kind of progressive political stance that was looking for a sort of, not a revolution, but a sort of a renovation in European politics and also in the church. At the time, they were opposed to sort of the very stringent dominance of the Catholic Church and were sort of involved in early days of the in a Protestant Reformation and things like that. So I wanted to show that it isn't a kind of formula, you know, occult plus politics equals fascism or equals, you know, far-right sort of radicalism. And let's say someone like Annie Besant, who was one of the successors to Madame Blavatsky, who had started the Theosophical Society in 1875, she started out as a suffragette and a socialist in England, and she wound up, after she became head of the Theosophical Society, she wound up being you know, a really important part of the Indian liberation movement. And people like Gandhi and Nehru, they both became theosophists, and they were both very, very grateful for the work that people like Besant and other theosophists did in sort of returning Indian and Hindu culture to the Indians at the time, who had lived under the Raj for many, many years. So I just wanted to show, like, well, you know, there's all these popular books saying, you know, any interest in occult and politics turns out to be fascist. Well, that's not really true.
Well, I was sort of fascinated by the picture of the White House on the cover of the book. And I was curious, where do you, as the author of Politics and the Occult, the Left, the Right, and the Radically Unseen, where do you see occult, the vestiges of the occult in modern politics, either in the UK or in here in the USA?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of stuff about a variety of different conspiracy theories or secret societies, like, you know, Skull and Crossbones and Bilderberg and all that. And I don't really touch on that, I have to say. My interest tends to be more historical. But the one area that I do talk about a bit in contemporary politics is, and strikes me as very much a form of occult politics, is the far-right Christian, fundamentalist Christian movement in the States. And I talk quite a bit about the Left Behind series of books and all that, you know, where there's sort of these rather sensational novels that show what America or what the world is going to be like after the rapture and all that sort of thing. And this struck me as rather kind of scary. I mean, when the book came out in 2008, the idea, you know, with Barack Obama being elected and all that, the idea was like, oh, maybe this is sort of, you know, you're beating a dead horse here. But I don't know. It strikes me that, you know, that could come back into power again. I was in the States not too long ago, back in April. I was in Florida teaching at a school for a week, and I had a real sense that there's a real strong undercurrent of something along those sorts of lines, a sort of very religious kind of. I mean, the central theme of, say, occult politics is that the politics is driven by not by economic reasons or by other sort of, you know, ordinary, common political sorts of motivations. It's driven by some sort of transcendental sense. You used that word earlier in the context of mysticism. It's driven by a set of transcendental values in some way, values that are more than the everyday sort of values of, you know, food and other forms of economic life. And, you know, we use the word transcendental, but it doesn't necessarily mean nice good or liberal or whatever. And I get a real sense from what I can gather over here about the sort of far right aspect of Christian fundamentalism there. That's pretty much what's going on. And the Nazis themselves, let's say, you know, they fell off the radar in the early 20s, in the mid 20s, after the failed Bierhold putsch. But you know, 10 years later, you know, Hitler was the most powerful man in Europe. So you know, if it's a dead horse, it deserves being beaten, I think.
Well, you know, the reason I say that, I'm fascinated by certain aspects of the occult as I see it. I could be wrong, but it's also mystical. And I think one of those ways that we see it on a daily basis is in the symbols that people use to communicate what they stand for, what they want people to fear, what they want people to love. And I think symbols are very powerful. I mean, we've talked even on a very basic level, the occult, I think, is still obviously a big influence on our money, in the sense that if we just had a piece of cotton and paper bill that was just marked $1, if it didn't have all of these magic symbols on it, we wouldn't think it was worth anything. And we have to have our magic symbols in all sorts of different ways, and yet we don't think of them as occultish. We don't think of that kind of symbolism as being necessary for our belief, but it is, I think.
No, I think you're right. I mean, well, symbols are very, very, they're central part of human life to begin with, and then especially so in an occult and mystical context, in the sense that they operate by reaching below or above or deeper than, you know, the conscious, reflective, critical mind. They can really get you in your gut, as it were. I mean, Jung himself wrote quite a bit about symbols and about their power to sort of do that, to get into your inside and affect you in some way. And I think in many ways we're probably affected by them, and we don't even know that we are. You know, our actions in many ways can be kind of guided by a variety of different sort of symbols. And we can react emotionally or viscerally in many ways, you know, meaning through the body. And consciously you might hold a different opinion about something, but some symbol or a set of symbols or a context in which you see them can affect you deeply and get below that. This is something that, again, I don't want to go back to the Nazis as the default setting, but they're very good at to this sort of thing. This is something that Hitler did understand. He did when he took the swastika, which had been around for quite some time. You know, it wasn't until the Nazi appropriation of it that it became this kind of dark symbol. It's a good luck sign, and it's quite common in a lot of different cultures. It's in Hindu culture, it's in Native American culture, and a variety of others. He just sort of recognized the power of it, and the bright red color, and you know, the SS troops wearing black and all that sort of thing. This is why, you know, the Nazis still seem kind of sexy to us. Compare them to the Soviets. Nobody's got any kind of real, you know, interest in the Soviet regime that much these days. Yeah, it all seems kind of dreary. And there's nothing about their customs or the hammer and sickle, because in some ways the hammer and sickle is a symbol, but it's a rational symbol. You sort of know what it stands for. Whereas with the swastika, it can evoke a whole sort of group of sort of uneasy feelings. You're not quite sure exactly what it means. You know.
Well, that's where we'll pick it up on a discussion then about symbols. Carl Jung, who is a Swiss psychiatrist, very influential thinker, somebody who has a great impact on many of us today. If you're applying for a job and you've taken the Myers-Briggs type indicator, the MBTI, then you're being affected by the teachings of Carl Jung. But we'll talk about his life, both studying the occult and mysticism and symbols, but also his life in the paranormal. And not many people know this part of Carl Jung's life. And we'll talk about it next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, mystic fire, exactly what we're talking about. Jung the Mystic. Gary Lachman is the author of a series of books that focus on mysticism and the occult. But in this new book, he approaches a subject that a lot of big fans of Carl Jung would probably rather him not, or at least that's how I understand it, because so many people find the paranormal to be invalidating. Carl Jung didn't. And in his lifetime, this founding father of modern psychoanalysis had many paranormal experiences. In fact, his last book that he wrote, I think his last book was about UFOs. And he didn't see any problem at all talking about this. And so I won't either. Coming up next, Jung the Mystic, next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Gary Lachman, the author of Jung the Mystic, about Carl Jung. So we were talking about how really some of his early work was about symbols, and he was really, he grew up, Carl Jung grew up in Switzerland, had a kind of a troubled upbringing, had lots of anxieties. He had lots of, you know, very interesting experiences, many of which predicated on the idea that he was a very bright kid and he was very bored, but he also had a lot of turmoil at home. But one of the things that sort of fascinated me from the very beginning of what you write here, Gary, is that his mother was prone to somewhat hysterical experiences from time to time, things that she was claiming were happening to her, but he was seeing her, he was seeing things happening, but paranormal like things happening around his mother. And he got wigged by it, but I mean, it wasn't just once.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Floating head and everything.
It's on his mother's side, you could say that the paranormal was in Jung's DNA, because her father, Jung's maternal grandfather, he used to keep a free chair at the dinner table for his deceased first wife. She would sit there, and then he would have conversations with her, much to the consternation of his living second wife.
Yeah.
Jung's mother was also, she had to sort of shoo the ghosts away from Samuel, her father, who was a preacher, and he was writing his sermons, and the ghosts of the dead would be bothering him while he was trying to write his sermon. So her job was to sort of stand around him and sort of wave her hand to keep the ghosts away. And then she herself used to fall into these sort of trance states. When she was a teenager, there was one point where she fell into a coma for about, 48 or 72 hours or something like that. And then she came out, she was speaking in tongues and a variety of other things. But the thing that Jung used to notice about his mother was that she seemed to slip into this other personality. Most of the time, she was a pretty average Swiss housewife, didn't have anything particularly profound to say and so on. But every so often, she would slip into this other sort of personality, speak in a different kind of voice, and she would say these rather deep, profound, sometimes prophetic sorts of statements. And this affected him a great deal. And he himself, when he hit his adolescence, something very similar to that happened. He discovered that he seemed to be two different people.
He actually had was it number two or the other guy, or what did he call it?
He used to call it, there was number one, which was his everyday, adolescent, boy character. And then there was someone that he spoke of as number two, the number two personality. And this was this rather masterful character from the 18th century who wore a tricorner hat and buckled shoes and carried a, sort of jeweled walking stick and drove in this rather fancy carriage. And Jung began to feel that he didn't come out and say, this is who he was in a past life. He never really comes out and says it in so many words. He doesn't really speak about reincarnation in that way. But the impression one gets, at least I got, was that he felt that in some way he was this character before, in some before time. And it got to the point where there was this conflict between these two sort of personalities in him. And in many ways, it presaged his other work, because a lot of his later work is about bringing opposites together in the personality in order to sort of go beyond both of them into something more, something that transcends either of the two.
We're talking about Carl Jung, the founding father, one of the founding fathers of modern psychology, and so much more too, which we'll get to coming up in just a minute. But what about the floating head, Gary?
Well, he used to have all these different weird kind of dreams, and there was a lot of tension between. I'm sorry?
Dreams? Do we want to call them dreams? He wasn't sleeping.
You know, again, I mean, dreams, trances, waking states, sort of waking dreams. I think they're all sort of part of a gradient. You know, you can sort of chart these things along a kind of, you know, gradually shifting sort of gradient where there's like dreams until sort of dreams start to invade your waking state, and then they, you know, consciously you're inducing visions and so on. And Jung was familiar with all of this stuff. But when he was a young boy, there was a lot of tension between his parents. Sort of any kind of love life, I think, had long since dissipated between the two of them. And Jung's father, he thought of his father as kind of a failure. Jung's father, again, was a preacher. Jung was surrounded by men of the cloth. I mean, it's a miracle in many ways that he didn't turn out to be a preacher himself. A pastor, because his father was, and on his mother's side, I think five uncles were as well. But his father had lost his faith, but he didn't know what else to do, and he just basically hung on to dear life for the rest of his life, just going through the motions of being a pastor. And there's a lot of tension, and Jung would have these rather strange dreams. There's this one very early one that he talks about was sort of coming into this kind of cave or this sort of hole where he discovered this huge, it looked like a tree trunk to him without any branches, a kind of smooth tree trunk, and on the top of which was a single kind of eye. Now, he later realized this was like a phallic symbol. And then he had visions of this sort of floating head coming out of his parents' bedroom. So a variety of different things. He had these sort of, I don't know what you want to call it, sort of an anxiety response, you know, to the tensions that were going on.
But he didn't think of them necessarily as an anxiety response. I mean, his mother was having these two personalities, and at night she could be very different. And he knew this. And yet I guess I'm reluctant to dismiss them as dreams. I think visions is a different word with a different meaning, but I think he thought Carl Jung, it seemed like he thought he was seeing these things and they were real, that the paranormal experiences that he had were real. No?
Oh yeah, I mean, by saying dreams, I'm not dismissing them, and certainly Jung would in no way consider a dream to be any kind of negative, you know, thing. In many ways, he would say, you know, dreams have a greater validity and greater life than our waking state. So. I'm just using it as a handy kind of reference, you know, that, but you have to remember, this is a boy, this is a 9, 10, you know, even younger than that, year old boy, so he didn't quite have the vocabulary to understand these experiences, and this is getting back to talking about symbols earlier, you know, even though he couldn't rationally understand sort of what was going on, if you want to call it his unconscious, his psyche was producing these symbols that were apt. They were very accurate response to what was going on in him. And he even talks about having this one vision of this kind of blue, kind of floating blue sort of circle made up of angels, these small angels. You know, and this is like an early image of what he would later call the mandala, which is this kind of projection that the psyche produces. Sort of indicating your psychic state at the time.
Well, you know, I think that's significant, though, because I think there's a lot of people. I know you tell me whether you think this is true. I think there are a lot of people I know who would go into a modern, you know, psychologist's office, a Jungian trained, you know, Jungian influenced psychologist, and talk about these same types of experiences and get a very different reaction than Carl Jung himself would have given to these people who said, I'm having this experience.
After the fact, I mean, Jung himself, there wasn't any Jungian psychology when he started out.
Right.
If you mean when Jung started out in his early years as a clinical psychologist, I mean, he worked for years at for Goldsley Mental Institute in Zurich, where he was basically, you know, cheek by jowl with psychotics, schizophrenics, people who are, you know, smearing feces over themselves all day long and talking about visions. And he was one of the first ones to actually start to pay attention to what they actually were saying.
That's what I mean, though. I just think that's...
Stuff. I mean, but just get back to what you just said. You could, if people went into a different kind of psychologist's office, not a Jungian, and started talking about these sort of things, they'd probably be prescribed Prozac.
That's what I mean. That's exactly what I'm talking about. And I think there are even some people who would consider themselves Jungian who would not be so receptive as Jung himself would have been to these to these paranormal experiences. And I think that's what people are, I think that's the cool thing about Carl Jung. I think that's the cool thing about your book. We're talking with Gary Lachman, the author of Jung the Mystic, is that you chronicle all of these things like his little, I'll phrase it this way, his childhood experiment in voodoo, right? This little guy, this little man that he made, explain this, where Carl Jung made a little guy and that gave a talisman that sort of gave him power.
Yeah, well, Jung talks about how important it is to have a secret, have some kind of secret that is really a secret. You keep to yourself and no one else knows. And it gives you a kind of centering. It allows you to sort of focus. And again, in his childhood, he made this little figure, a little stick figure. He carved it out of a wooden ruler, and he painted it and sort of made of like a top hat for it and an old sort of frock coat and all that. And he put it in a sort of pencil box, and he hid it up in the attic, like in the rafters up in the attic of the house. And it was one of a sort of series of kind of defense measures that he took to kind of keep himself together, basically, when he was experiencing all this sort of tension and you know, the overflow of the uneasiness between his parents. And whenever he felt, you know, really tense, he would go up into the attic and look at this figure. And it was his figure. He also had another sort of experience with the stone. It was the stone he used to sit on. You know, when he was out in the fields, and he would sit on the stone, and he would say, "This is my stone. This is his stone." And it's fetishistic. It's an example of what Jung would later talk about in terms of the collective unconscious. It's a way of you get in touch with this pre-rational, you know, pre-logical kind of part of the psyche that has a mythical relationship with things around it. And he would have this mythical relationship with the stone in the sense that it somehow could secure his own personality. And then he used to make these little fires, these tiny little fires inside. There was a wall that had these little sort of, you know, holes in the wall that he imagined as these little caves, and he made little fires to keep those going. And again, this was another sort of ritualistic thing. And this is, you know, this is the sort of thing that, especially at that time, the late 19th century, you know, and the whole push towards science, and rationalism and all that, and you know, just on the cusp of modernity, get rid of superstition, get rid of all this kind of stuff, you know, he would have been sort of smacked probably to do that, you know.
Well, I think you're hitting on something there too. I know what you're saying when you're talking about being fetishistic, but I think there's also something, the fact that he could just be in a bad place, like something going on in the house, upheaval in the house, and it brought him power, or it brought him a sense of well-being. I don't think that's too strong an association to just think about his little man inside that little pencil box up in the attic. All he had to do was think about it, and he felt better. I mean, I just think that that's, I mean, I think that's such an interesting, I mean, it's so primal, you know, it's something about that.
But again, that's what I I'm not using fetishistic in a negative way. Carl Jung himself would say it's perfectly, you know, fine, or he would say perfectly rational, to do this, because this is part of our psyche. You know, he later in life, he both in the American Southwest and then in Africa, he visited indigenous people, and he was quite impressed by how they, you know, performed rather similar rituals to what he himself did when he was younger, and saying this is evidence for this part of, just because we're modern, just because, you know, it's the 20th century, that doesn't mean that all this stuff has gone away. You know, we haven't got rid of it there. It's sort of pressed down in us now. And his later psychology was about, well, we need to find a way to give that its due, allow that its expression, because if you don't, then it'll come out in neurotic ways. It'll come out in ways that'll basically screw you up. I think you're absolutely right. He could think of this figure, and it would bring him a kind of sense of balance.
And that thing that brought him a sense of balance, that figure up in the attic, is what a lot of people would think of as neurotic, which is ironic that he it brought him balance and he it fought off neuroses. But that brings me back to where something you just said a minute ago, and I want to ask you: should psychoanalysis be considered science?
Well, this is the big thing. I mean, there's two parts of that. In the first place, Jung himself spent all of his career saying repeatedly that he was not a mystic, he wasn't an occultist, he was a scientist. He was a scientist. He wasn't a philosopher. He wasn't a religious thinker. He was a scientist. In the broader psychoanalytic community, he was considered exactly all those things that he just, told us and everybody else he wasn't. So the Freudians considered Jung, it's finally come out. He's just this occultist, mystic, nothing, no science at all. Freud considered what he was doing science, and Freud's followers did. Now, today, most people don't consider what Freud was doing the science. They consider it kind of pseudoscience, because most of his theories have been shown to be like, well, actually, they don't hold water.
Right.
And with Jung, it's even worse than people because, well, Freud at least, tried to hold to, rationalistic methods and so on. Jung, as say in the book, certainly in his later career, he came right out in the open and was talking about things like astrology and alchemy and all this kind of stuff that most straightforward rationalists just considered complete superstition and screwball wackiness.
Sure.
So I think these days psychoanalysis isn't considered a science, but I think, what's important about it isn't whether it's a science or not. I think with Jung, Jung seems to have had more successes with his methods than Freud did.
Well, okay, but as a non-science,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I'll let you finish.
I was going to say, as you mentioned, neurosis, the stuff about the figure would have been considered neurotic, and in many ways Jung would say yes. But the thing with neurosis is an attempt to effect a cure, and neurosis actually is a good sign. It's the psyche, it's the person trying to come up with some way of dealing with the feeling of disorientation or imbalance or whatever the problem is.
Okay.
They're trying to do something about it. And him, it was always a good sign when people started to display neurotic behavior.
Well, okay, so let's go with psychoanalysis. Whether it's Freud or whether it's Jung, not considered science. Maybe, as you said, Freud would be considered pseudoscience, and yet they can prescribe pills. For non-scientific, there's a lot of handing out of pills. It's almost like it makes me think that really. Psychoanalysts, and this is where why don't we pick it up here in a minute, Gary, on this subject, that psychoanalysts are really modern day shamans. You have to find the right shaman to fit you, but if you find that one, they can dispense potions. They can give you they can give you a prescription for something that is supposed to change your life. But it's really not any different than, say, going to some South American shaman or some shaman in the Orient and have them give you something that they grind up in their shop. It might work. It might be great. You might have this great eat, pray, love experience, or you might have to hit the road again and try somebody else. And so I want to ask you, when is psychoanalysis closer to mysticism or the occult? As Gary's been researching the life of Carl Jung, the mystic, when is psychoanalysis more like mysticism or the occult? Next, on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett.